bending the timbers of the decking on the dock in front of our houseboats, and since the dock decking is common property, it is his business. Furthermore, he thinks that burning wood in a stove contributes to serious air pollution problems, and I am therefore irresponsible for not heating my house some other way. Right, I agree. That's exactly why I have so much firewood. I don't burn it anymore. But this guy keeps yawping at me, and I'm a little steamed, and suddenly I have a genius solution for the firewood fracas. Gentlemen, I say to the young men at my door, I have a job for you. They are excited. You see all this firewood along the dock? Yes. Well, I want you to haul it all up onto the street, where you will find my neighbor's very large four-door green Buick sedan. And I want you to fill that Buick with this firewood. There's probably too much firewood to go in the trunk, sir. Exactly. So I want you to fill the whole inside of the Buick completely with firewood, door to door, floor to ceiling, carefully. And if you have any left over, I want you to stack it on the hood and the roof, doing it carefully, of course. Oh, we couldn't do that, sir. We might get in trouble. How about I pay you $10 each and you do it at night? Well, we could do that, sir, but what if we get caught? For an extra $5 apiece, you will not get caught. Right, sir. We understand. And besides, I tell them, at 15 you're still juveniles. They won't give you the electric chair for misplacing a pile of firewood. Just do it. I'm tired of being patient and reasonable and fussing around with the minutiae of life. Direct and swift action is my mode these days. A one-man SWAT team am I. Don't mess with me. My neighbor is lucky I didn't pile up the wood on his front porch and set it on fire. After all, who would believe that a nice man like me would do such a thing? I've worked hard all these years on my disguise of benign gentleness, but the time has come for the bad Samaritan to rip off his mask and strike. So, the neighbor is away sailing for the weekend, and I happen to know where he keeps his hide key, in a really dumb place under the rear bumper of his Buick. I saw him put it there. I make sure his car is unlocked, and during the night I hear the lovely sound of firewood being moved by desperate 15-year-olds. The next morning I am pleased to find the wood gone, and the Buick looks like a movable wood yard. Ha! Brilliant! I'm thinking my neighbor is going to have a cow when he gets home. Funny. Well, did this really happen, you may ask? I mean, would I go that far? Well, yes and no. Almost. The young men did come to my door. The neighbor and the firewood are real. And the whole scenario from beginning to end did flash through my mind. I could see his car filled with firewood. I could see him coming home. And the thing even went as far as the midnight moment. And there was a time in my life when I would have gone through with it, yes. But now, well, I am, alas, older and wiser. Too bad. I stopped the young men, middle of the night, paid them. But I had considered that my neighbor is a cunning devil with a wicked sense of humor. He would have got even. He would have paid the young men to stack the firewood in my bathroom. Not so funny. And then I would have, well, who knows what would have happened. Maybe I'm going through a desperate transitional phase now at 66, like I did at age 15. I often have these loony ideas and come close to acting on them. But maybe, and however, well, the imagined memory must suffice sometimes. If you only make it up, you never have to live it down. I'll take you now to Weezer, Idaho. I once spent a week in Weezer, Idaho. Maybe that's hard to believe, because if you've ever looked on an Idaho map, you know Weezer is way out in nowhere. But if you play the fiddle, Weezer, Idaho is the center of the universe. The Grand National Old Time Fiddlers Contest is there the last week in June, and since I've fiddled around some in my time, I went. About 4,000 people live there in normal times. About 5,000 more come out of the bushes and trees and hills for the contest. The town stays open around the clock, with fiddling in the streets, dancing at the VFW hall, fried chicken in the Elks Lodge, and free camping at the rodeo grounds. And people from all over show up. Fiddlers from Pottsboro, Texas, and Sepulpa, Oklahoma, and Thief River Falls, Minnesota, Caldwell, Kansas, Three Forks, Montana, and just about every other little crossroads town you care to mention, even Japan and Ireland and Nova Scotia now. It used to be that the festival was populated by real country folks, pretty straight types, short hair, church on Sunday, overalls and gingham and all that, and then the long-haired hippie freaks began to show up. The trouble was that the freaks could fiddle to beat hell, and that's all there was to it. So the town turned over the junior high school and its grounds to the freaks. The contest judges were put in an isolated room where they could only hear the music. Couldn't see what people looked like or what their names were, just hear the fiddling. As one old gentleman says, "Son, I don't care if you're stark naked and wear a bone in your nose. If you can fiddle, you're all right with me. It's the music that counts." So I was there in Weezer, standing in the middle of the night in the moonlight, Weezer, Idaho, with about 1,000 other people who were picking and singing and fiddling together, small groups, some with bald heads, some with hair to their knees, some with a joint hidden behind their back, some with a long-neck bottle of Budweiser behind their back, some with beads, some with Archie Bunker t-shirts, some 18 and some 80, some with corsets and some with no bras. And the music rising like incense into the night toward whatever gods of peace and goodwill there may be connected to music. I was standing there, and this policeman, a real, honest-to-God, on-duty, Weezer, Idaho policeman, who is standing next to me and picking a banjo, really, I swear it, says to me, "Sometimes the world seems like a fine place, don't it?" "Yeah." "Don't believe me? Go see for yourself. Weezer's still there. The festival still happens. And the music goes on." Here's a Bible story, not the usual Bible story, but you'll get the connection. As a former high school teacher, I'm often invited to reunions. Sometimes the reunions are very private, one-on-one, as happened last week. While a student was in town for a class gathering, he called to ask, "Could we get together for a cup of coffee? I have something to get off my chest." His confession cleared up a long-standing mystery. In his senior year, he had called me at home on a Sunday afternoon to say that he knew I was a parish minister and, well, he had an urgent religious question to ask. Serious possibilities passed through my mind. "Sure, go ahead. Mr. Fulgham, do you know how to clean puke out of a Bible?" "What? It's awful. I just can't tell you, but I've got to do something before my mother gets home. I couldn't help him. There are some things not covered in seminary, and I admit to being chicken-hearted. A prudent man avoids a mess like this. So on Monday, I asked what was going on, but he said I wouldn't really want to know. Now, 10 years later, comes the truth. His parents were away for the weekend, and he had done exactly what they told him not to do, have some friends over for a party. Sound familiar? Of course. And there was beer, and a girl drank too much, lay down on the bed in his mom's room and tossed her cookies big time. Trying not to throw up in the bed, she aimed over the side and hosed the nightstand, and on the nightstand lay the mother's family Bible open. These things happen. They do. All evidence of the party could be cleaned up except the mess on the Bible. Desperate, our tragic young hero wrapped the evidence in a plastic bag, and he buried it in the backyard. He bought his mom a new Bible, told some terrible lie about borrowing hers for a high school project and losing it on a bus. She was really mad, but not nearly as mad as she might have been if she knew the truth. He could handle his mom's wrath. She would never know. But he knew God knew, and he was sure God was going to get him. The experience kept him out of trouble and in church for the rest of his senior year. Now, 10 years later, he still hasn't told his mom the truth. He still thinks she would kill him if she knew. But it wasn't just any old Bible. It was the family Bible passed down from his grandmother to his mother. And the Bible is still out there in the yard somewhere. Of course, he's forgotten exactly where by now, but if he knew, he would sneak home sometime when his mother was away and dig it up. Of course, he wouldn't be able to explain why the backyard was full of small craters, and who knows what condition the Bible would be in by now, but that's his plan. "Well," I said, after laughing myself limp, "the only thing I can do for you is to give you an example of the things adults and teachers and parents do that are just about as awful and as stupid as what you've done. At least you will know you have company." So I told him my tale. That same spring of his senior year, I had a very full teaching load. My classroom was on the third floor, and the nearest men's toilet was 3 floors down. In desperate circumstances, one morning in the middle of a class, I excused myself, walked swiftly down the hall into a closet to use the janitor's sink, only to find the sink had a sign on it saying, "Does not drain." Panicked and about to explode, I used a large plastic bucket that was handy. Snapping the lid on the bucket, I moved it into an art supply storage closet. I had the only key, no problem. Alas, the convenience of this solution to my problem was too easy not to use again another day, and by the end of the week, I had a different problem. What to do with a bucket containing a rather amazing amount of urine? So late one afternoon, long after school was out, I tried sneaking down the stairs with the bucket to empty it in the toilet 3 floors down. I stumbled on the stairs and let go of the bucket, which sailed through the air and exploded like a mortar shell into the hallway. True, I swear I did this. Disgusting, yes. Stupid, oh, yes. Go ahead and beat me up over this, nice man like me. But tell me you never did anything dumb or gross in your entire life. Tell me you never had to clean up your own stupid mess. Besides, what I did was not illegal, not immoral, or a sin, just stupid. Remember, the Bible says those without guilt should throw the first stone. Well, it took a couple of hours to mop up the mess, a couple of bottles of air cleaner to kill the smell. When people complained the next day that something awful seems to have happened in the hall overnight, I kept my mouth shut and have until now, actually. "Welcome back to the best part of the reunion," I said, "to the Bible barrier, where the truth can finally be told. Maybe, someday, his mother will tell him the stupid things she did behind his back, and then they can go out and dig up the backyard looking for her Bible." Big change of subject. This concerns the names of things. Anybody seen a naked broom rape, a bastard toad flax, or a lesser dirty socks, or a crouching loco weed? These items are listed in various field guides to the wildflowers of North America. Listen again. Naked broom rape, bastard toad flax, lesser dirty socks, crouching loco weed. I am not making up these names. I can show you the photographs, too. Trying to mitigate my ignorance and to stop asking, "What's that?" of anybody I go hiking with, I've been working my way through the field guides and stumbling over these truly wiggy labels. My suspicions are aroused. Do these flowers with the bizarre names really exist, or is there some conspiracy among botanists to pull the public's leg? Well, if the plants are really out there, then I'd give a prize to meet the yahoos responsible for sticking such miserable names on nature's blooming flora. How could you look at a flowering plant and say, "Let's call that sucker a naked broom rape"? Especially when the purported flower has a pale violet trumpet shape with a dab of purest yellow in the center. You've got to be in a bad mood to do that. Worse, I want to get a look at the crab who had the peevish gall to say, "Well, that looks like a bastard toad flax to me." I mean, what was this man smoking? The actual plant is small. The complex flowers pale ivory, and the leaves olive green. Bastard toad flax? Come on. And someone must have had a bad day in the bush when they declared, "See that? I say that sorry son of a bitch deserves to be called a crouching loco weed," referring to a plant with slender leaves bearing a tall flower with multiple silvery white petals. Crouching loco weed indeed. And as for dirty socks, a pinkish flower with touches of purple in the middle. I'd like to see the socks of the one who did the christening. I've seen ugly and unlaundered socks on some hikers, but I wouldn't stick the name on a plant. All I can figure is that some plant mavens have a sour sense of respect for the subjects of their vocation. Field guides are full of mean-spirited adjectives, the lowly this and the false that and the dwarf whatnot and the pygmy something else. Wonder what they name their dogs and cats and children. I'd sure like to know what was going on in the mind of the guy who named a small yellow sunflower the nipple seed. I'd like to meet his girlfriend, too, if he ever had one. So, who cares, really? There are lots better things to get stirred up about, aren't there? I mean, I suppose political correctness in naming wildflowers is not a bandwagon with much steam behind it, though dumber matters do get a lot of press. But I do wonder what would happen if we were to wipe the slate clean of all the names for things around us and start over. If our generation were responsible for labeling the environment, would we do any better, be any kinder to our plant friends? Probably not. Can you imagine the meetings, the congressional hearings? Besides, the experts tell us that the evolution of living things continues at such a rate that plants and animals and insects come into and go out of existence faster than human beings can catalog them. The number of living things we have identified and named is far outnumbered by those we don't even know about. Most of what we have named is dead and gone, actually. There may well have been a naked broom rape once, but it may well be extinct by now. Something else will take its place, and we get to name that one. Better job next time. Sometimes we actually do a better job. My favorites from the field guides are the rosy pussy toes, the enchanter's nightshade, and the chocolate lily. Progress. I wonder what flowers would call us. Creeping fat farm fungus, deadly sucker bush, night screaming doodlebugs, weeping wookie weeds. Well, almost every living species has been here far longer than ours. The fossil evidence is very clear. And many will likely be here long after we've wandered off into the doomsday dustbin ourselves, still sticking stupid names on things as we went. Scientists tell us the Earth has been around 4.5 billion years and has another 5.7 billion to go. What does a flower care about what label we apply in passing? The labels only stick to us. Well, now, from the names of flowers to another obvious subject, water. What kind of water will you have? A question asked by my hostess at a dinner party. She offered fizzy or flat, French or Italian, mountain glacial or deep artesian. I could also choose natural or flavored, iced or room temperature, with lime wedge or lemon twist. Actually, I was surprised at the somewhat limited choices offered by my hostess. Our corner grocery store alone carries 31 brands of bottled water from sources in France, Canada, Wales, Germany, Italy, Norway, as well as the U.S., even the island of Fiji. The water comes from ancient springs, high mountain streams, and mineralized deposits. Three colors of bottles, clear, sea green, and deep blue, and all with elegant labeling. This is designer water. It has taken its fair share of abuse for appearing to be a pretentious extravagance, but the same criticism could be made of the marketing of beer, wine, hard liquor, or even films and novels and music. The appeal is to the imagination, to the romantic side of human nature. And me? I like fancy water. I'm delighted to drink a glass of liquid that began as snow in the French Alps hundreds of years before I was born, then became ice in a glacier melted into deep underground springs, and finally was bottled and hauled all the way across sea and land to sit available on my local grocer's shelf. For a very small price, really, I can have a reflective reverie in a glass, an ordinary glass that reveals the wonders of nature, the inventiveness of the Industrial Revolution, and the pleasures of a poetic view of life. Moreover, this liquid is good for me. It is me, as a matter of fact, since 90% of my body is water. I'm pleased to have my essential juices get an occasional transfusion of fanciful pizzazz. Now, there is a high end of the water market, as yet untouched, rare and historic water. I'm thinking beyond natural purity of water that has value because of its age or its association with special events or because there simply is no more of it ever to be had. This is the fine wine division of bottled water. A few examples. Several years ago, a former student of mine brought me a liter of water all the way from the spring at Delphi in Greece, a source from which the noble Greeks of the 4th century drank when they went to consult the oracles of fate. I drink a little every April Fool's Day. One Christmas, my wife gave me a bottle of water from the creek we hike alongside in summer. She had carefully filtered the water and filled the bottle on my birthday. I've great memories of fine days in that valley. We drank a toast with the water during our Christmas dinner, a toast to past happiness and present joy. I know a man who saved a bottle of Colorado River water from the days when the river ran free, before the Glen Canyon Dam turned it into a silty lake. That bottle sits on a shelf in his office in a place of honor, marking both his younger days and the time of an American West that's gone forever. Sometimes he smiles when he sees it. Sometimes it brings tears to his eyes. Powerful water. Once I participated in a lovely christening ceremony that used baptismal water that had been collected from the rain dripping off the fly of a tent during the camping weekend when the couple conceived their first child, this child being christened. And I attended a first anniversary dinner celebration of an April wedding that had been turned into a magical occasion by an unexpected snowfall. The bride's father had collected the melting snow and now brought the bottle of water as an anniversary gift. Priceless. There's no commercial value in water of this kind. There are only two secret ingredients which can't be manufactured or bottled. Imagination, and memory. Such vintage refreshment is always a product of home brewing. The liquid is flavored by experience and given character by the creative effort it takes to fill the wine cellar of the heart. Let the glasses be filled and lifted. Cheers. This next essay is called Third Aid. My wife has tried for some time to get me to read news stories about people who live long and healthy lives. She's a doctor and a semi-vegetarian. She's excited about studies of isolated groups of people who dwell 12,000 feet up in the Andes or way out in the Russian boondocks. They eat chickpeas and gravel and walk 6 miles a day to get water. Shriveled up old prunish people whose life secret seems to be that they never change clothes or take baths. Not my idea of a long and happy life. I've seen their pictures. They look ugly, unhappy, and bored, and I don't want to be one of them, or married to anybody like them, actually, either. I think long life is as overrated as natural childbirth. I'll pass on both of them, thank you. Most of the really old people I've known are a royal pain in the butt. Oh, sure, tell me about your sainted mother or your wonderful great-grandfather and how they lived to be 150 years old. I said most of the old people. My personal plan I would call, third aid. Not first aid. That's what you do in immediate crisis. If you cut yourself, you spend a half hour looking all over the house for a Band-Aid and then settle for scotch tape, and that's first aid. Second aid is calling the doctor because you've got the flu, but by the time you actually get in for a checkup, the flu is gone. While you've been waiting, you've got some extra sleep, been patted on the head, taken some aspirin, and eaten some chicken soup, you're cured. Third aid is my version of preventive medicine, so you don't need as much first and second aid. I read through my wife's medical school textbooks, and I noticed that in just about every crisis, the drill was the same. Have the patient lie down in a comfortable place, make sure the patient can breathe, make sure the patient isn't bleeding, and is kept warm and dry. I think this is called the ABC checkup for airway, blood, and comfort, or something like that. In addition to this ABC business, I read about the placebo effect. That's where, no matter what you do, anywhere from 30 to 60% of what gets wrong with you heals itself if you just give it time and think good thoughts. It's kind of like staying amused while your body does its thing. See, the truth is, doctors can really do something with only about 15% of what ails you. Your body does the rest, or you die. If you want to practice third aid, what do you do? Well, first, get this and get it clear. Realize your body makes house calls. It's always there with you. So does your brain. This is crucial. Every once in a while, when you are not sick, lie down and examine yourself. Feel yourself all over. Ask yourself three questions. Am I breathing? Am I bleeding? And am I comfy? If your answers are yes, no, and yes, you are going to live a while longer. Then ask, am I hungry? Am I thirsty? Is there anything in the house to eat? And if yes, eat and drink. If not, don't. This is important. If you know something isn't necessary or isn't good for you, don't get up and do it. And if you do it anyhow, don't complain about it. Just lie down and shut up and wait. It's elemental. When in doubt, get down. Take a nap. Try reading a human body manual. You'd do as much for your car or your stereo or your stove. Why not your body? I read that 90% of doctors' visits depends on their giving attention and getting our trust. I figure if I pay close attention to myself and trust my body, I don't have to bother the doctor. Ah, but suppose I have something serious and really need a doctor. Well, I'm personally ambivalent about calling on a doctor. That's because I live with one. I'm told that most of us will die in a hospital bed hooked up to tubes and wires. Not me. I want my body to go way before my brain goes. I want to die at a dance or a delicatessen from way too much fun or food. Of course I won't live to be 100. So, who would want me to? Here's an essay on yelling. In the Solomon Islands in the South Pacific, some villagers practice a unique form of logging. If a tree is too large to be felled with an axe, the natives cut it down by yelling at it. I can't lay my hands on the article, but I swear I read it. Woodsmen with special powers creep up on a tree just at dawn and suddenly scream at the top of their lungs, and they continue this for 30 days. The tree dies, falls over. The theory is that the hollering kills the spirit of the tree, and according to the villagers, it always works. Ah, those poor, naive innocents, such quaintly charming habits of the jungle, screaming at trees, indeed, how primitive. Too bad they don't have the advantages of modern technology and the scientific mind. Me, I yell at my wife, and I yell at the telephone and the lawnmower. And I yell at the TV and the newspaper and my kids. I've even been known to shake my fist and yell at the sky sometimes. Man next door yells at his car a lot, and this summer I heard him yell at a stepladder for most of an afternoon. We modern, urban, educated folks yell at traffic and umpires and bills and banks and machines, especially machines. Machines and relatives get most of the yelling, but we never thought of yelling at a tree. I don't know what good it does, the yelling. Machines and things just sit there. Even kicking doesn't always help, and as for people, well, the Solomon Islanders may have a point. I've noticed that yelling at living things does tend to kill the spirit in them. Sticks and stones may break our bones, but words, especially if they're yelled, will break our hearts. Now another all-time favorite story of mine. It's about a kid named Donnie. The rap on the door was sharp, urgent, insistent, a foreboding of crisis. Rappity, rappity, rap. Me rushing to the door, fumbling with the lock, pumping my adrenaline, prepared for emergency. What? Small boy. Odd expression. Hands me a scrawled note on much folded paper. My name is Donnie. I will rake your leaves. $1 a yard. I am deaf. You can write to me. I can read. I rake good. Across the back of our house is a row of middle-aged, matronly maple trees, extravagantly dressed in season in a million-leaf sequins. And in season the sequins detach. Not much wind in our sheltered yard, so the leaves lie about the ladies' feet now like dressing gowns they've stepped out of in preparation for the bath of winter. I like the way it looks back there. I like the way it looks very much. My wife does not. The gardening magazine does not like it either. Leaves should be raked. There are rules. Leaves are not good for grass. Leaves are untidy. Leaves are moldy, slimy. But I like leaves so much. I once filled my classroom at school ankle deep with leaves. There is a reason for leaves, say I. There is no reason for mowed grass. My wife does not see it this way. There is an unspoken accusation in the air of laziness. And we have been through this before, but this year a bargain has been struck in the name of the scientific method. Half the yard will be properly raked, and the other half will be left in the care of nature. Come summer, we shall see. And so her part is raked, and mine is not. Let it be. Like a pilot in a fog relying on limited instruments, the little boy looks intently at my face for information. He knows I have leaves. He has seen them. Mine, in fact, is the only yard in the neighborhood now with leaves. He knows his price is right. Solemnly he holds out pencil and paper for my reply. How can I explain to him about the importance of the scientific experiment going on in my backyard? How? In a way, you know, the trees are there because of the leaves. With unbridled extravagance, zillions of seeds have helicoptered out of the sky to land like assault forces to green the earth. The leaves follow to cover, protect, warm, and nourish the next generation of trees. Stony ground, rot, mold, bacteria, birds, squirrels, bugs, and people all intervene. But somehow, some make it. Some tenacious seeds take hold and hold on and hold on for dear life. In the silence of winter's dark, they prevail and plant themselves and survive to become the next generation of trees. It has been thus for eons, and we mess with the process at our peril, say I. This is important. My name is Donnie. I will rake your leaves. $1 a yard. I am deaf. You can write to me. I can read. I rake good. He holds out the pencil and paper with patience and hope and goodwill. There are times when the simplest of events call all of one's existential motives into question. What would I do if he weren't deaf? What will it do for him if I say no? If I say yes, what difference? We stand in each other's long silence, inarticulate, for different reasons. In the same motion, he turns to go, and I reach for the pencil and paper to write solemnly, yes, yes, I would like to have my leaves raked. A grave nod from the attentive businessman child. Do you do it when they are wet? I write. Yes, he writes. Do you have your own rake? No. This is a big yard. There are lots of leaves. Yes. I think I should give you $2. Ha ha! A smile. Three, he writes. A big grin. I laugh. Done. We have a contract. The rake is produced, and Donnie, the deaf leaf raker, goes to work in the fast-falling November twilight. In silence he rakes. In silence I watch. Through the window of the dark house. Are there any sounds at all in his mind, I wonder? Or only the hollow, empty sea sound I get when I put my fingers in my ears as tightly as I can? I don't know. Carefully, he rakes the leaves into a large pile as instructed. Yes, I am thinking, I will spread them out over the yard again after he is gone. I am stubborn about this. Carefully, he goes back over the yard, picking up missed leaves by hand and carrying them to the pile. He also is stubborn about his values. Raking leaves for him means all the leaves. Signing that he must go because it is dark and he must go home to eat, he leaves the work unfinished. Having paid in advance, I wonder if he will return. At my age, I am cynical. Too cynical. Good morning. He has returned to his task, first checking the previously raked yard for latecomers. He takes pride in his work. The yard is leaf-free. I note his picking up several of the brightest yellow leaves and putting them into the pocket of his sweatshirt, along with a whole big handful of helicoptered seeds. Rappity-rappity-rap, he reports to the door, signing that the work is done. As he walks away up the street, I see him tossing one helicoptered seed into the air at a time. Fringe benefits. I stand in my own door, in my own silence, smiling at his grace. Fringe benefits. Tomorrow, I will go out and push the pile of leaves over the bank into the compost heap at the bottom of the ravine behind our house, and I will do it in silence. The leaves and seeds will have to work out their destiny down there this year. I could not feel right about undoing Donnie's work. My experiment with science will have to stand aside for something more human. The leaves let go, the seeds let go, and I must let go sometimes, too, and cast my lot with another of nature's imperfect but tenacious survivors. Hold on, Donnie. Hold on. In parenthesis, I should add that I'm often asked about Donnie. People want to know what happened to him. Is he okay? Respecting his privacy, it's enough to say that Donnie did hold on. He graduated from college in horticulture, married, runs a wholesale nursery business, specializing in trees. That's the truth. Now for something a little ridiculous, a chicken story. It won't seem like that for a while, but be patient. The chicken is coming. Help prevent tectonic plate movement. This is a message on the T-shirt worn by the man standing beside me in line waiting for the Powell Street cable car in San Francisco. A tourist. He's wearing the required silly tourist shirt. His wife's shirt says, "Hello, I'm an idiot from Wisconsin. Please help me." This I could comprehend, but her husband's stand on tectonic plates was jabberwocky. Help prevent tectonic plate movement? Driving west from Wisconsin, he had tried to explain the landscape to his children, but they wouldn't buy the theory of tectonic plate movement. No way was a huge chunk of the continent floating around on lava and pushing up against the United States and making volcanoes and earthquakes and mountains as it slid under us. No way. Dad was hooted into silence by the children's raspberries of disbelief. His wife discovered the T-shirt in a kitschy souvenir shop in Reno. He wore it as a hair shirt of humility. You know, the determined skepticism of the young makes fierce and uncompromising adversaries. His kids don't believe half of what he says anyway. He and I reflected on science and fatherhood. We concurred that it is the burdensome duty of adults to profess knowledge unconfirmed by direct experience. All that deep stuff you learn while growing up, you learn it, but you don't really believe it. We swapped examples. For openers, you're told how babies are made. Unbelievable. No way. Almost as incredible as learning the earth will fall into the sun someday. Or how about being told that algebra has a use in the real world outside school? Ha! And the Ice Age, that has to be a hoax. Half of North America covered with glaciers, 1,000 feet of ice over Wisconsin, never. Split brain theory is another Lulu. Words in one half of your head and music in another? Come on. How about black holes in space, quasars and quarks? Oh, sure. You go around pretending that you are up to date on this theoretical stuff, but in your heart, you know a lot of it must be dreamed up by scientists bent on upsetting us civilians. Based on personal experience, however, some of this UWA information does compute. Combining several theories already mentioned, I am certain that the two halves of my brain have slid apart, leaving a black hole in the middle caused by the algebra quirk. You can believe it. The all-time Wonko idea is that birds are dinosaurs. Direct descendants right out of the Jurassic jungle? Oh, sure. However, fossil evidence of feathered dinosaurs really exists. And furthermore, I know of a fowl that is living proof of this hypothesis. The chicken's name is Clucky Lucky, the cannibal chicken of San Luis Obispo, California. One Easter weekend, somebody's present of a baby chicken got loose and wound up in the backyard of a pet-crazy family, friends of mine. They raised her as Clucky Lucky, the nomad chickette that grew up to be a substantial lady chicken of the Rhode Island variety. Cute, as chickens go. But in her mature years, Clucky Lucky had grown unusually large for her breed and began to wander the neighborhood. She terrorized cats and ate their food. She assaulted dogs, chased people who annoyed her. When she began laying rancid-smelling eggs and began coming home in what was a distinctly inebriated condition, a veterinarian was consulted. Investigation proved that the chicken had been eating cat food made out of chicken parts, and she was drinking beer out of traps set to kill slugs. Alas, Clucky Lucky had become an alcoholic cannibal. I have seen photographs of this chicken. This chicken is real. Scaly legs with clawed feet, razor-sharp black beak, and yellow eyes that seem to shine with an ancient fierceness. Blow this bird up to the size of a water buffalo, and you've got a dinosaur. It's logical, too. If birds are dinosaurs, and chickens are birds, then chickens are dinosaurs. Or if B equals D and C equals B, then C equals D. Finally, a use for algebra. I explained all this to my tourist colleague as we rattled along on the cable car. When he and his family dismounted, I heard his wife say as she walked away, "Not all the idiots are from Wisconsin." "Never mind, lady. I know what I know. I'll never turn my back on a chicken again." Here's a short essay on a big subject. It's called Pickup Truck. Transportation is much the topic of the day. You've noticed our devotion to the car is worshipful. Guys, especially, will talk cars for hours. Eric Byrne, the psychiatrist, called it the cocktail party pastime game of General Motors. Despite what you hear, it's not really a matter of economics. It's an image issue. In America, you are what you drive. Go out in the garage and look. There you are. Well, my old hoopy has joined the cripples on the edge of the herd, and a new vehicle, image, is in order. The silver-gray Mercedes convertible with glove leather everything really felt like me. The bank did not really think it felt like me to them. The shiny black BMW motorcycle with sidecar kind of felt like me. My wife did not think it felt like her, especially the sidecar part. The Land Rover with gun rack and shooting top felt like me, but there are so few game-covered belts around here now. The new VW Bug is Consumer Reports' choice, but a bug, I am just not. If they had named it the VW Walrus or the VW Water Buffalo, I might go for it. One of my former students suggested I put all my money into drugs, stay home, take all the trips I want, but that's not me either. You don't bring back groceries from those trips, and nobody really envies you, and we must be envied. It's clear that what would be fashionably hip is a fine piece of engineering, something that's luxurious, yet practical, useful, and economical, like a Porsche pickup truck that runs on Kleenex, silver gray, of course. But what I really want from transportation is not an image, but a feeling. I remember riding home on a summer's eve in the back of an ancient Ford pickup truck with 2 8-year-old cousins for company and my Uncle Roscoe at the wheel. We'd been swimming and were sitting on inner tubes for comfort and had a couple of old quilts and an elderly dog wrapped close for warmth. We were eating chocolate cookies, drinking sweet milk out of a mason jar, and singing our lungs out with unending verses of 99 bottles of beer on the wall. With stars and moon and God above and sweet dreams waiting at the end of the journey home and not a care in the world. Now that's transportation. That's the way I like to travel, and that's me. And if you hear of a dealer, let me know. This next piece is about a mystery entitled Dead End. This should be called The Mystery of 25th Avenue Northeast, and the story has semi-cosmic implications. It's about the fact that strange things happened where we once lived at the dead end of a dead-end street, 2 blocks long, at the bottom of a hill in North Seattle. It wasn't much of a street to look at in the first place. I mean, it really didn't call to you to come down it. Kind of narrow and crooked and cluttered up. Ed Weather's van and his brother's GMC 2-ton flatbed truck and the Dill's old Airstream trailer were just part of the vehicular obstacle course. Still, you could see all the way down from the intersection at 95th to the end of it. And there were 2 signs up there at 95th, too, one on each side of the street. Big yellow and black signs both said the same thing, street ends. And down here at our end of the street was another sign, a big sign, black and white with stripes and reflectors and all. Dead end is what it said. Right in the middle of the end of the street it said that, and you could see it for a long way off. Well, for all that, people just drove on down the street anyway. Not just partway, mind you. Not just to where the reality of the situation cleared up. No, sir. They drove all the way down, right up to the sign, the big black one with stripes, the one that said, Dead End. And they read that sign 2 or 3 times, as if they were foreigners and had to translate the English. They looked on either side of the sign to see if there was a way around it. Sometimes they sat there for 2 or 3 minutes adjusting their minds, and then they backed up and tried turning around as close to the sign as possible. Backing and filling between our yard and Miss Polsky's marigold bed and the blackberry bushes across the street, running over some of each. And the funny thing is that once they got turned around, they never drove away slow and thoughtful as if they'd learned something. No, no. They tore away up the street at full throttle, as if fleeing evil. There was no pattern. All kinds of vehicles, all kinds of people, broad daylight and pitch dark, even a police car a couple of times, and once a fire truck. What's going on here? Innate skepticism or innate stupidity? I confess, I do not know. A psychiatrist friend tells me it's a sample of an unconscious need to deny that everyone wants the road or the way to continue on instead of ending. So you drive as far as you can, even when you can clearly read the sign. You want to think you are exempt, that it doesn't apply to you, but it does. Now, I was wondering if I had printed that up and then put little copies in a little box and attached it to the sign that said Dead End with a smaller note that said, Free information explaining why you are here, take one. If I had done that, would people have read it? Would it have made any difference? Would they have been more careful of the lawn and the marigolds and the blackberry bushes? Would they have driven away any slower? Well, I don't think so. Perhaps I should have put up a sign at the top of the hill that said, Wayside Shrine at End of Street. Come on down and confront the ultimate meaning of life. It's a dead end. What effect would that have on traffic? I wonder. Recently, I went back to visit my old neighborhood after many years away. The street is still a dead end, and not much else has changed. The neighbors say the unbelievers still drive all the way down to the sign, turn around, and flee. And life, it's still a dead end. And we still have a hard time believing it. Now, I want to tell you about testing. It's been real quiet around our house this month. My wife is studying for her exams. Every 7 years, she must take and pass an all-day examination in order to be certified by the American Board of Family Practice Physicians as competent in her profession. She's liable for everything she's learned about medicine since the first day she walked into medical school. As for me, I panic just knowing I have to renew my driver's license. I haven't taken an exam since college. Just being in the same house with someone who is studying for an exam gives my brain the worry willies. But it's a provocative notion, this business of being recertified every 7 years. I wonder how it would be if all of us had to take a major exam as we pass through the decades of our lives after formal schooling was over. Suppose we had to prove our competency and proficiency as members of the human race. And if we didn't pass muster, we'd have to go back to class for retraining. It makes some sense, actually. See, the only reason we're required to go to school in the first place is that we believe a nation is better off educated than ignorant. It works for the common good. But just because we got through the system doesn't mean anything really stuck or that we know how to apply what we know, does it? Sometimes I am appalled by my own ignorance. One of my favorite Peanuts cartoons has Lucy asking Charlie Brown, "Charlie Brown, don't you wish you knew back then what you know now?" Charlie stares blank-eyed for a while and then asks, What do I know now?" Think about it. What do you know now? Just what should we have nailed down cold in our brains by, say, age 30, to justify our education and our continuing participation in life with people? Well, reading and writing, of course, still the basics. Right away, there's trouble. Did you know that 22% of adult Americans are functionally illiterate? About 40 million people would not pass basic reading and writing. It's true. As to math, we should at least be able to add and subtract and multiply and divide, even fractions. No algebra, though. If algebra's on the test, I'm going to get sent back to junior high school for the rest of my life. What else? Well, history's got to be on the exam. We get into continual peril because we lose track of the long and wide view of human experience. And basic civics, that's got to be tested. When only 38% of the eligible voters show up at the polls at a national election, some of us need re-education about democracy. So basic economics and personal finance have to be on the exam. Make a simple budget. Demonstrate knowledge of balancing a checkbook. Ah, right. If you haven't got sex figured out by the time you're 30, you better go back to class. Basic health, first aid, they should be current. But love, well, that may have to be left off the exam. Most of us will never learn. What else? How about knowledge of ethics, law, ecology, and science? Sure, but all that is tidy fact stuff. What about more subtle things? What should you know by 30 about art, music, literature? Or how about friendship, honor, courage, truth, beauty, happiness, hope, imagination, wisdom, humor, and death? Whoa, this is getting out of hand. There's so much you should know It seemed like such a good idea when I began. I'm already over-questioned. And we haven't even dealt with the existential items, such as, why is there something instead of nothing? Or, when will I have time, and who knows where the time goes? Or, how deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? When is enough enough? What are people for? Is there life before death? Is it true that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing? Or, if birds fly over the rainbow, why can't I? Another favorite old story now, Homage to the Buffalo Tavern. One portion of a minister's lot concerns the dying and the dead, the hospital room, the mortuary, the funeral service, the cemetery. What I know of such things shapes my life elsewhere in particular ways. What I know of such things explains why I don't waste much life mowing grass or washing cars or raking leaves or making beds or shining shoes or washing dishes. It explains why I don't honk at people who are slow to move at green lights and why I don't kill spiders. There isn't time or need for all of this. What I know of cemeteries and such also explains why I sometimes visit the Buffalo Tavern. The Buffalo Tavern is, in essence, mongrel America. Boiled down and stuffed into the buffalo on a Saturday night, the fundamental elements achieve a critical mass around 11. The catalyst is the favorite house band, the dynamic volcanic logs. 8 freaks, frozen in the amber vibes of the 60s, playing stomp-hell rockabilly with enough fervor to heal the lame and the halt. Mongrel America comes to the buffalo to drink beer, shoot pool, and dance. Above all, to dance. When it's Saturday night, and the logs are rocking, and the crowd is rolling, there's no such thing as death. Just dancing. One such night, the buffalo was invaded by a motorcycle club trying real hard to look like the Hell's Angels and doing pretty good at it, too. I don't think these people were in costume for a movie, and neither they nor their ladies smelled like soap and water were an important part of their lives on anything like a daily basis. Following along behind them was an American Indian, an older man with braids, beaded vest, army surplus pants, and tennis shoes. He was really ugly. Now, I'm fairly resourceful with words, and I would give you a flashy description of this man's face if it would help, but there's no way around it. He was, in a word, ugly. So ugly, he was beautiful. That kind of ugly. He sat working on his Budweiser beer for a long time, and when the dynamic logs ripped into a scream-out version of Jailhouse Rock, he moved. Shuffled over to one of the motorcycle mamas and invited her to dance. Most ladies would have refused, but she was amused enough to shrug, get up. Well, I'll not waste words. This ugly, shuffling Indian ruin could dance, and I mean he had the moves. Nothing wild, just effortless action, subtle rhythm, the cool of a master. He turned his partner every way but loose and made her look good at it. The floor slowly cleared for them. The band wound down and out, but the drummer held the beat. The motorcycle club group rose up and shouted for the band to keep playing. The band kept playing. The Indian kept dancing. The motorcycle mama finally blew a gasket and collapsed in someone's lap. But the Indian danced on alone. The crowd clapped up the beat. The Indian danced with a chair. The crowd went crazy. The band faded. The crowd cheered. The Indian held up his hands for silence, as if to make a speech. Looking at the band, and then the crowd, the Indian said, "Well, what the hell are you waiting for? Let's dance!" And the band and the crowd went off like a bomb. People were dancing all through the tables to the back of the room and behind the bar. People were dancing in the restrooms and around the pool tables, dancing for themselves, for the Indian, for God and man, dancing in the face of the existence of hospital rooms and mortuaries and funeral services and cemeteries. And for a while, nobody died. "Well," said the Indian, "what the hell are you waiting for? Let's dance. And so say I. A big shift now from the Buffalo Tavern to an essay about a gummy lump. I watched a man setting up a Valentine's Day display in a store window. It's the middle of January, but the merchants need to get a jump on love, I guess. Don't get me wrong. Merchants are fine folks.